The Canadian Anti-Apartheid Oral Histories Project was produced in association with the 3rd Annual Institute of African Studies Conference and Feshrift in honor of Linda Freeman, Solidarity and Shifting Patterns of Hegemony in Southern Africa, Historical and Contemporary Perspectives, which was held on March 1st and 2nd, 2018, at Carleton University. This Oral Histories Project consists of interviews with participants of the conference, including activists, aid workers, diplomats, and politicians, who volunteered to discuss their personal experiences as part of the anti-apartheid movement in Canada. The interviews were conducted by Susan Bazilli, PhD student at the University of British Columbia, and by myself, Michael Buchert, a PhD student at Carleton University. In this interview, Stephen Gelb sat down with me to talk about his experiences with the Toronto Committee for the Liberation of Southern Africa. This was recorded on February 28, 2018, at Carleton University.
My name's Stephen Gelb. Well, I'm South African. I grew up in South Africa and left South Africa at the age of 21, 1976, to come to Toronto as a student. I'd started studying already at the University of Cape Town. I left South Africa in large part because of the war in Angola. I had, at the end of my high school, I had served a year in the military, the South African military, which, you know, white kids had to do. And in 1975, when South Africa invaded Angola, 2 years after I'd finished my military and started university, the South African Defense Force started to call people who had recently done their military training to expand their forces in Angola. And so I wasn't terribly keen on that. And an opportunity, because I have some family here in Toronto, the opportunity came up to move to university in Canada. So I decided to do that and ended up in Toronto.
And how did you start to get involved with the anti-apartheid movement in Canada?
Well, as a teenager, high school student in Cape Town, where I grew up, I was involved in a socialist Zionist youth movement that was oriented towards the kibbutz movement in Israel, but was also given, it was South Africa, the late 60s, early 70s, was also, and run by university students, very focused on apartheid and what that meant. This was the moment when there was very little open resistance in South Africa, in the beginning of the 70s. But then in 1973, actually while I was in the military, you had a wave of strikes in South Africa, which sort of began to revive internal opposition. And so when I started university in 1974, I became, given my background as, you know, sort of politically aware person on the left in some broad sense, I became involved in student politics, and in particular in a group that was engaged in worker education around worker rights in Cape Town. So I did that, you know, not very actively, but somewhat actively for a couple of years. And then this situation happened with me moving to Canada. But between the time that I applied to come to Canada in the early 76, and the time I actually moved in September 76, the Soweto uprisings happened. And at the University of Cape Town, where I was studying, we had lots of protests and we were arrested and various, you know, not that unpleasant, but, you know, important events happened. So when I arrived in Canada, I was already looking for some kind of anti-apartheid role. And after 2-3 months being here, I discovered this group Ticklesac, because they were hosting a day-long event, I forget exactly what, and so I went along to that. So that's, and then as a result of that, became very actively involved with them.
So can you tell me about I guess, your involvement with Tickle-Sack then and what you were doing with that organization.
Well, for the first... I lived in Toronto for 5 years. For the first 3 years, I was a volunteer. It was a small organization, mm-hmm. 2 people full-time. The rest of us were volunteers. And we basically organized public meetings, which, you know, in the early days that I was there would attract 100, 150 people. This was in the wake of Soweto, and then, you know, it sort of dropped off a bit. But when we were also working, of course, on Namibia, mm-hmm. and on Zimbabwe, and someone still on Mozambique and Angola. And we did a lot of public education. So, you know, I got quite involved in sort of university student activities, would go to other universities around Ontario and give talks about apartheid, mm-hmm. church meetings. And then we also did a lot of sort of study, I would say, of South African political economy amongst our own group, to try to understand better what was going on in mm-hmm. South Africa and how we should relate to that. So, you know, really for the 3 years I was a student at U of T, the sort of third and fourth year of undergrad and my master's year, I probably spent more time doing that work, political work, than I did on my studies, mm-hmm. formally speaking, but I learned a lot. And then at the end of my master's, happened to be a vacancy in the office for a full-time person. And so I then started working full-time for the next 2 years.
Mm. And any of those activities, did they involve boycotts or divestment pushes?
No, that was
later?
No, that was what it was all about.
Okay.
You know, boycotts, I mean, things like the fruit and the wine boycott were already well underway by the time, continued to be a focus. We put a lot of emphasis on disinvestment, trying to get Canadian companies to disinvest from not just South Africa, but Namibia. I mean, Hudson's mm-hmm. Bay was a big focus, Falcon Bridge in Namibia. And then from about 1979, 1980, the Canadian banks that were lending to South Africa became sort of the biggest single focus, I would say, around the divestment. But we also worked with other groups around to support them and publicize, groups in other countries, I mean, around things like the oil boycott. Canada wasn't supplying oil, but, you know, it was part of the bigger picture.
Mm. And a lot of the work at the time seemed to be coalition-based, or a lot of networks of different kinds mm-hmm. of organizations. Mm-hmm. So from the perspective of someone working at Tickle-Sack, what did those coalitions look like?
Well, you know, we saw ourselves as part of the independent left in Canada, meaning not the Leninist left, which was the Communist Party, but also a lot of other small groups of different sorts who all were interested in South Africa, but we did not relate to them. We also saw ourselves basically separate from the NDP and sort of mainstream politics. So the independent left was essentially a lot of groups who were focusing on a number of issues in Canada around sort of things like Indigenous people's mm-hmm. rights, some union and labor activity, but a lot of it was international work. And so we worked most closely, I would say, with people working on Latin American dictatorships. Chile, Argentina, Brazil were all mm-hmm. newly transformed, or whatever, into authoritarian and military dictatorships. So we had a lot of contact with those people. A little bit with the rest, with other parts of Africa, but I would say Latin America was the big.
Mm. And did you cooperate, or I guess collaborate with like NGOs like Oxfam?
Yeah.
Or other sort of different kinds of organizations?
Yeah, sorry, I should have mentioned. I mean, we worked very closely with Oxfam Canada and also with CUSO and with the churches. Mm-hmm. So, you know, a lot of people in the churches were obviously very engaged with South Africa as church people, but some of them certainly were active in their own personal capacities in Tickelsack. Mm-hmm. And through the, you know, we worked then closely in trying to get, help them get their congregations and their priests and so on to understand South African realities and mm-hmm. essentially preach to their congregations. Mm. Oxfam and CUSO, we were part of that kind of broader left, independent left coalition, I would say. And again, there was a lot of crossover of personnel.
Were there divisions in the within these collaborations?
Well, we collaborated most closely with the people with whom we politically agreed, who were kind of socialist, but not enamored of the Soviet model. That's you know, that's probably the best way of, nor of the sort of NDP approach to social democracy. Mm. So the divisions were along those lines. So we worked to some extent with the ANC people in Canada and with the Canadians Concerned About Southern Africa, which was their sort of Canadian allied group, but not that closely because our politics were very different. And they became very, the problems became sharpened, I would say, at least while I was living in Toronto, by things like the Soviet invasion of Poland and the declaration of martial law that I think was in 81, but as the solidarity movement in Poland became stronger, the tension sort of rose. We were, I think, very much supportive of solidarity. I would say the Communist Party people were not that supportive. Ethiopia, I remember, was another issue because the Soviets basically supported a military dictatorship at that time, which we were not, and the ANC did as well, and we were unhappy about that.
What was your impression of the ANC and other liberation movements in Canada at the time and their role in the anti-apartheid movement?
Well, I think the ANC was very weak in Canada. I'm sure they would disagree, but I don't think that, you know, at that time the mainstream Canadian opinion was that the ANC are a bunch of communist terrorists, you know, to put it very crudely. And the ANC was never able to break that until the mid-80s, I would say, it began to change, which was around the rallying around the sort of figure or persona of Mandela. Mm-hmm. But in the late 70s and early 80s, the ANC was not able to communicate with mainstream. And I think some of the, I don't want to malign particular individuals, but the way they went about it was not convincing to even left-wing Canadians, let alone mainstream Canadians. They were very far from the center of the organization, which was, of course, was in Lusaka and Tanzania to some extent, but also London. Mm. Toronto was very far. Communication was not what it is today. It was much more difficult, and it just felt peripheral.
Did you take direction from them in any sense? I mean,
no.
Not in a direct way, but like, were they seen as the exclusive voice of South Africans that you needed to listen to?
No, I would say not. In fact, you know, in Tickelsack, after long discussion and debate, we came up with a very short statement of our position on the ANC, which was important because it was clear that the ANC, I'm talking now about 1978-79, the ANC was the major national liberation movement and sort of organized political force outside of South Africa, but speaking for black South Africans. And so we had to take a position. And the position that we came up with was what we called critical support. In other words, we support them because they are the main voice of the struggle that we wanted to support, but critical because we didn't agree with them on a lot of issues, such as Ethiopia, Poland, or internationally, but also increasingly as opposition and resistance inside South Africa grew, we found that we had a different view of what was happening than did the ANC. And so they were extremely unhappy with the idea of critical support. They loved the support, but not the critical. And then, in fact, in 1981, I wrote a book, short book, with John Saul, who was also in Ticklesack, which sort of argued that the ANC was the kind of main representative and the sort of bearer of national liberation. I mean, we were very dismissive, for example, of the PAC. We saw the Black Consciousness Movement as having sort of crested and already in decline explicitly. But we were very supportive in the book and in our work in Canada of on-the-ground popular resistance, in particular the sort of rising labor movement, which was then very much nascent, but we saw as very important. And the ANC people, and in fact there were SACTU people as well in Toronto, were not happy with us, let's put it, and not about the book, and even the ANC mainstream in the UK and in Southern Africa dismissed the book. I mean, there was a review of it in Sachaba, which was in the ANC's journal, which was very hostile, because they said we were supporting groups that were like FASATU, for example, which were not sufficiently, in their view, aligned with the national movement, etc. So there was a lot of tension around that, I would say, yeah.
Did Ticklesack engage in much, I guess, official lobbying with the government?
With the Canadian government?
With the Canadian government?
No, it was very much on the margins of that.
What was your impression of the government's response, not to Ticklesack then, but to the broader anti-apartheid movement?
Well, in the late 70s, I left Canada in 84. In 81, I came to Toronto in 76. 81, I moved to Winnipeg to do a PhD at the university there, and then obviously left Ticklesack and became involved in MAC, Manitoba Anti-Apartheid, which was a much smaller, even further from the center than we had been in Toronto, and then went back to South Africa in 84. And it was only after 84, in my memory, that the Canadian government started to take more seriously South Africa's politics, let's put it that way. Up until the mid-80s, they were not, it just wasn't an issue. It wasn't important enough. The cost to the Canadian government was not significant of ignoring it, and that's what they did.
Right.
By the way, one thing I should mention that I think is important is that, you know, the independent left movement was completely fragmented organizationally. And that's why there was a Toronto group and there was a Winnipeg group and there was a Edmonton group, Vancouver. And then there was the whole Quebec scene, which was, of course, also completely separate. And that was, I think, a very weak point, actually. I mean, of course, coordination was expensive and nobody had any money and it was difficult because of the size of Canada and so on, but it was, I think, one of the reasons why the movement was a lot weaker than it might otherwise have been, because there was no coordination, everybody just did their own thing.
Right. Did that translate into different types of strategies being taken up by different groups?
Yeah, every local group just did its own thing. I mean, you know, there were contacts. The reason I moved to Winnipeg, for example, was because I had met, through my anti-apartheid work, I'd met an economist at the University of Manitoba who was interested in Africa and involved in anti-apartheid. So I went to work with him. And so there was a lot of contact, but there was no coordination. It would have been unthinkable for somebody in, say, Ticklesack to say to somebody in Winnipeg or Vancouver or wherever, we're doing this campaign, you should do it. It was completely up to their discretion what to do and how best to express their commitment.
Right.
Anyway, so I think that's something that's actually quite important about the Canadian, because it was different, of course, in the UK, and in fact in most European countries. It was to some extent different in the US mm-hmm. as well. There was, I think, a bit more coordination.
Yeah. Were there any efforts to coordinate just locally in Toronto?
Well, in Toronto there was Ticklesack. There was some church people, which, you know, who we engage with, but mm-hmm. some of whom came to our meetings. There was the ANC, but we didn't really coordinate with them because we didn't want to take instructions from mm-hmm. them. They tried to get us to do more what they were doing, but we were not keen. Mm-hmm. So, no, even on a local level, there wasn't great coordination.
Right. Mm-hmm. Looking back, it appears sort of in the historical memory that the international solidarity efforts of the anti-apartheid movement played a big role in the end of apartheid. I think that's the historical narrative that we hear. I wonder what you think about that.
Yeah, I wouldn't call that the historical narrative.
Oh, you hear a different one then. What do you think is the
narrative?
Look,
I went back to South Africa in 1984, mm-hmm. just before the UDF already existed, mm-hmm. the unions were already strong, they weren't completely united into one federation, but I got back just before the sort of outburst of open resistance, which ultimately led to the emergency. And in fact, my view is shaped by that. Mm-hmm. I wasn't sitting in Toronto or Winnipeg when the ANC was unbanned. I was in South Africa. And for me, the main driver was the movement inside South Africa, not even the ANC, mm-hmm. the movement inside South Africa, in the unions in particular, but to a considerable extent also in the communities, the UDF, although the UDF sort of fell apart during the state of emergency, the unions much less so. But that energy was still the most important. And then mm-hmm. the key impact of the international anti-apartheid movement, as it turned out, was something which they didn't really achieve directly, but indirectly, and that was the what I call the financial sanctions, the stopping of bank loans, which were imposed not by governments but by the banks, the market, and which really tightened the squeeze on the South African economy, and was one important factor in bringing South African business, big business, to the recognition that things had to change, and then the unions were the other important mm-hmm. factor, and that's sort of what led to de Klerk and the unbanning and so on. So of course the international movement was very important in kind of laying foundation ideologically and so on for what the banks themselves decided to do, but ultimately it was a risk-based decision.
Mm-hmm.
And so I wouldn't say it was the international movement. Yeah, in fact, I had debates after I got back to South Africa with people, and I'm going to refer to this tomorrow, with people who I'd worked very closely with, Americans, not Canadians, who basically argued that strategies and tactics of labor and church and sound organizations in South Africa should really be subordinated to the needs to build a boycott movement in their case in the US. And I found that A, politically wrong, and B, ethically wrong. We actually had some pretty serious discussion. But I think in the end change happens in the country, not through international pressure, mm. although international pressure is very important in weakening the dominant power, let's say.
What about the role of armed struggle? What do you think was the significance of
that? Again, very limited impact because, you know, let's be frank, the ANC was a hopeless military force. You know, they did there were a few important attacks, but they were few and far between, and there were a lot of people got arrested and put in prison. They were no match for the South African Defence Force. And, mm-hmm. you know, at the end of the day, if the ANC had been a more effective military force, the whole process of transition would have been fundamentally different. They did not defeat the South African military by any manner of means.
Mm-hmm. Are there any other impressions that you had being in South Africa in the later 80s? Is there anything else you can say about your impression of the role of international solidarity at that moment?
Well, you know, after I went back to South Africa, because I'd been here in Canada for 8 years at that point, and had lots of connections and, you know, in the history here, while I was in South Africa, I provided a lot of assistance to various Canadian organizations, including government people, by the way, but also particularly to Oxfam, sort of helping them develop their networks in South Africa and, you know, basically facilitating their activities, which were essentially to support the opposition. And the Canadian government at that time, to its credit, this I'm talking now about 86, 87, 88, was quite active in providing help to bits of the democratic opposition in South Africa through the churches and through other organizations. So, you know, that was very important because, you know, actually what was possibly the most important thing was the money, which is not something I often say, by the way, but South African organizations in the opposition, whether it was unions or churches or, you know, I was working then, I had a few friends and I started a little group consultancy, really, to assist the unions in their negotiations with employers. Because they, you know, I was an economist, I had some ability to understand some of the technical issues which union officials didn't have. But we were a consultancy in that we were asked to help by different unions, but of course they didn't really have the resources to pay for us. We were paid for by international donors, some Canadian, some European, and that was very important. But there, and we were not by far not the only group. There were quite a lot of little organizations which were supported in this way, which provided kind of professional expertise, which I think was very important for these organizations. And then the mass organizations themselves needed money to organize their meetings and their rallies and pamphlets and all of that. And so, you know, how did all that happen? A lot from international aid. And I think that's a very important contribution that was made. But I wouldn't say that meant it was driven by the anti-apartheid movement, but that, you know, the anti-apartheid movement had a very valuable contribution to make.
In the end, what do you think were the main factors that led to the end of apartheid at the moment that it did?
Well, the economic sort of squeeze that South Africa faced, and the because of the debt issue, and the recognition that that wasn't going to change for a long time unless there was some kind of democratization. And then that would sort of release that pressure on the economy. The union, the recognition by South African business that they had to keep talking to the unions, and actually it was better for them in terms of their long-term interests to have a stable workforce that was relatively well paid and so on, and had good working conditions. And so attempts, you know, to have an authoritarian disruption of that relationship, which was the sort of hardline position, were opposed by business. And then thirdly, the mass protests, which I wouldn't say they made the country ungovernable, but they made it a lot more difficult to govern. And so, you know, that could not continue indefinitely. Either that would be a massive crackdown, which would have enormous costs to the ruling class, or there had to be an opening up. And I think that the collapse of the Soviet Union and the Eastern European bloc and the Berlin Wall and all of that, that was very important because I think de Klerk felt that this would weaken the ANC so much that if he unbanned them, he could control the way things unfolded,
mm-hmm.
which, you know, of course, turned out to be a complete miscalculation and was always going to be a miscalculation. That was very evident.
Mm-hmm.
But I think that was part of the calculus as to why he did what he did then, without, to be honest, all that much support even in his own party.
Mm-hmm. I want to ask what the experience was of going through that historical moment, if that makes sense.
Mm-hmm.
It's easy to sort of, or I don't know if it's easy, but it's one thing to retrospectively look at all the factors and what led to it, but what was it like in that moment of like rapid change?
Well, it was very exciting because you really felt you were seeing, but also part of history happening. And, you know, I mean, I, at that point, was quite closely advising the trade union leadership on economic policy issues. And then subsequently, you know, once the ANC reestablished itself inside South Africa, advising them too. And so you felt that you were really part of what was happening and that mm-hmm. you had a real opportunity to influence it. So, you know, I think one of my main memories was just of feeling quite privileged, actually, to be in there and doing what I was doing then.
Mm-hmm.
Also anxiety because, you know, we were all not just inexperienced, we had zero experience of actually running a country or, you know, shaping policies. We had to kind of learn on the fly as we were doing it, you know, build a plane while it's in the air sort mm-hmm. of thing. And that was not easy. And it was a difficult moment because there was no, you know, we had all come out of, and I'm talking now about my South African colleagues who were also involved in policy discussions. We'd all come out of a socialist milieu where, although we didn't like the Soviet model, the idea that, you know, somehow the state would be more prominent in the economy and mm-hmm. would manage things and, you know, address poverty and job creation and so on. And suddenly, you know, that whole, the collapse of the Soviet Union also sort of destroyed not just that specific model of the socialism, but basically a much wider spectrum of socialist models. So we had to kind of reconfigure our whole orientation in a way, and globalization was suddenly becoming the thing, opening up to the world economy, which was always had seen been seen as a risky business. But yet that was the common sense in the mainstream that we had to deal with, and we had to decide how to manage that. And that led to a lot of debates, both within the movement, but also with mainstream people in that 90 to 94 period. Lots and lots of discussion and,
mm-hmm.
you know, challenging. But it was very exciting.
Mm-hmm. How do you feel the ultimately the constitution that was reached and sort of the transition itself, how do you think they did?
Looking at it then or looking at it now?
Because
I think it's two different.
I'm curious in both, yeah.
Well, look, my immediate reaction, to be quite frank, when the ANC was unbanned was, this has happened too soon. Because the movement on the ground was not sufficiently strong. And I felt that the odds, the sort of balance of power, was stacked against the liberation movement. Business was was very, very strong. The world was sort of against the ANC, and the chances of a progressive outcome were not very high. And also, by the way, at that time, Zimbabwe was was slipping much more quickly into decline. And as you may know, the IMF came into Zimbabwe in 91, I think, but the signs were already there in 90 that things were not unfolding very well. And so that kind of future loomed quite large. Mm. You know, we had a meeting, the first meeting of economists and political organizations from inside South Africa and outside South Africa happened in Harare in May 1990, and I was very involved in organizing that. And sitting in Harare, you felt very strongly that, you know, Zimbabwe offered one destination, which was not the best. So one wasn't hugely optimistic, but it was also an opportunity to maybe make a difference. And so, you worked very, very hard to try to make that difference and change things. The constitution itself, of course, is a fantastic constitution. And, in fact, Canadian lawyers had quite an important role in helping to shape it. Mm-hmm. But, of course, in any country, there's a difference between what's written in the constitution and what happens on the ground. And South Africa's done reasonably well. I think the role of the Constitutional Court in the last 20, 25 years has been absolutely critical and remains very critical. But a lot of what's in the Constitution hasn't been met, inevitably. Of course, now looking back at, what's been happening in South Africa in the last few years and even in the last few weeks and days, it doesn't look great. And that's sort of the Zimbabwe future, which always had a non-zero chance of happening in many respects, but that's what it was. But, I think that there's still some hope, and I think that what happened in South Africa, there was a certain degree of, I wouldn't say inevitability, but, democracy had to happen. The chances were there that it wasn't going to go all that well, but that doesn't mean that it shouldn't have happened. Mm-hmm. Of course, things are better than they were simply because people have a political voice and they can, get rid of a president who's a problem. So that, I think in that respect it's gone very well. Economically, in terms of distribution, poverty, not so great. But then partly that's not simply what's happened in South Africa, but what's happened in the world economy. Mm-hmm. So, in the early 1990s, there was a group in the ANC that I was part of, which was trying to think through economic policies. And in 1990, I believe, but perhaps it was 91, the IDRC was encouraged, I think in part by Jerry Halina, who was a U of T economics professor, who actually I'd studied with a bit in my student days. And he was a very prominent Canadian development economist at the time. And he encouraged the IDRC to start engaging with the ANC on economic policy. And he and my former supervisor, John Loxley, and a Tanzanian economist, Benno Ndulu, were sort of sent on a mission by the IDRC to come to South Africa and come up with some project that the IDRC could support around economic policy development. And what emerged out of that was something called the MERG project, which stood for Macroeconomics Research Group, which was basically financial support given to the ANC to pay for a whole range of South African economists to do research on different aspects of the economy, policy-oriented research, with the involvement on a part-time basis of international economists from here, but also from Europe and the US, Australia. And that produced, I think, some important work which helped to shape ANC economic policy. This is in the period before 94, but where the debate about the future shape of the economy and the ANC's credibility as a government was very much up in the air on the business side, let's say, and international investor side. And that was actually a very crucial event. There were a lot of problems. There were big political disputes within it about different directions. This issue of how do you relate to globalization was a key divide within the group. But nonetheless, I think it was a very important Canadian intervention, which was then replicated by the IDRC in other areas on education, I think on urban policy and urban structure, housing, urban planning, and so on, and a few other rural development, I think. So that was, you know, Canadian public funding supporting policy development in a very real way, which didn't bring about the liberation per se, but was part, you know, a crucial part of it, along the same lines as Canadians contributed to the constitutional negotiations supporting the ANC. This was a thing we didn't have much experience. And so having people like Jerry Helena and others who had experience at least of advising developing country governments on a range of issues was very critical.
This was an interview with Stephen Gelb, conducted by Michael Buchert on February 28, 2018 at Carleton University, as part of the Canadian Anti-Apartheid Oral Histories Project.